Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comic book, graphic literature, manga podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Mick.
Yay!
And Andrew.
Hello!
So, how are you guys today?
Well, I'm better than last week, because I can talk, which is, after all, the basic requirement for being on a podcast.
He's alive!
It's just a shame that that's not going to be for the best of us.
Let's not go too far. Let's not go using the alive word, but I'm audible.
Are you secretly an undead, Mick?
You may well think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Are you a vampire?
What did you get told before recording started about searching questions?
Privacy issues. Okay. I apologise for asking personal questions, Mick.
Otherwise, we'll have to explain why you're not on next week's episode.
No, don't exile me to Cinema Eclectica. I'll be good.
Or there'll be no exile.
4Panel would like to officially state that we can't disclose whether or not Mick is a vampire without his consent. As per data protection laws, which I've had to look at today, I'm an adult now. It's terrible.
Leaving those things to one side, things have been happening. What's been happening in the news, Andrew?
Okay, so first up, we have a trailer for the I Kill Giants movie.
Yay!
It stars Madison Wolf, Zoe Saldana, and actress with possibly the best name in all of Hollywood, Imogen Poots.
Yes, as soon as her name flashed up, I was thinking, that's an amazing name.
It actually sounds more like a hobby that she has.
Exactly.
Hi, Imogen. Off Putin.
I think it belongs in the same category of names that have clearly just been made up to mess with people's Benedict Cumberbatch.
No. It's Emerson Cumberbund.
Sorry, you're right. Emerson Cumberbund. No. That was going to be a joke where I mispronounced Cumberband, but then I actually genuinely mispronounced it too much and just had to trail off.
I thought you were going to head into Archibald Tumbleweed territory.
I'm so tired, guys.
All right, okay. Have you guys read the comics?
No, this is why I was hoping that Rob would be able to say things.
Okay, I am going to say things. I'm a big fan of the comics. I think the comics were really, really well done. And yeah, the language is a little bit stilted because the character of Barbara Thorson, she's trying to speak in kind of, you know, the Walt Simonson Thor style. Where it's all these and those.
The very low-key, I would have words with thee.
Yeah, basically like that. And so she comes up with lines, because she's got this little purse, and inside the purse is supposed to be a hammer called Kovaleski. And she says, when Kovaleski speaks, the world cries, which I think is an amazing line for a kid to say. And I'd have respect for any kid who said anything like that. But I've heard about this adaptation for a while, and I'll be honest, I'm a little bit cagey about the trailer.
I'll be honest, it looks like formulaic kiddie adventure film to me.
See,
fantasy adventure.
This is why I'm a little bit on edge about the trailer, because the comics they're a lot deeper and have much more meaning in terms of what they're what is actually going on.
But, yeah, I think from the trailer, all we really saw was it's the fairly typical little girl says that monsters exist, but do they, or is she just making it up to cope with stuff?
And what was that one with Liam Neeson playing a giant tree? I forgot.
A Monster Calls.
Yeah, A Monster Calls. I was getting vibes of that from the trailer.
And I think this is a symptom of the phenomenal success of comic book movies and TV series over the last few years, is that now Hollywood sees it as a way of making big bucks out of a paucity of ideas. And they're taking good properties and trying to just bang out a common old garden blockbuster with them and diluting the very essence that made them great graphic novels or comic series in the first place.
Yeah, you're exactly right. When it comes out, I am definitely going to see it, but whether I like it or not is a different matter.
Yeah, so am I, but only because I've got an unlimited card. If I had to, actually pay good, hard-earned cash to go see that movie, based on that trailer, I probably wouldn't.
See, I would, but only because I'm a fan of the comic book.
See, what I'd be more tempted to do is say, hey, Rob, lend us the comic book.
Actually, that's a good point. Hey, Rob, lend us the comic book.
Yeah, Rob.
Okay.
But yeah, I'll probably see it. Maybe.
Well, like I said, it's a trailer. There's not much we can go on from the trailer.
Yeah, I just think as a trailer that's meant to get you infused and hyped up for the film, it's fallen a little bit flat.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the dialogue seems... I understand the dialogue is kind of stilted in the graphic novel, but there's no need for you to kind of to do stilted dialogue in the adaptation. Just the lines they were coming out with, it just felt very, very bland.
Well, yeah, but that's pretty much what I got from the trailer. Oh, look, it's a bland child fantasy rites of passage type movie.
No, shush, Patrick Stewart. Not your time yet.
It's now a danger to society.
So anyway, but we're back now after what is presumably a fairly harsh cut. Because no word of a lie, Patrick Stewart invaded our podcast and we couldn't make him go away. Which I guess serves as a lead-in to the news that Logan's only blooming well gone and got an Oscar nom.
Oh?
Yep, it is nominated for Best Screenplay, which makes it the first ever movie based on a superhero comic to get nominated for Best Screenplay.
Excellent.
But of course, it's not. If it wins, it won't be the first superhero film to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
Because remember, guys, Suicide Squad is an Oscar-winning film.
Well, I'm not too happy with the Oscars as it is.
No, the Oscars are a ridiculous sham of a once-respectable industry. But, you know, actually, you know, I was even going to say, but hey, well done for nominating... But no, not well done for nominating Logan. About bleeding time for nominating Logan.
Yeah. I looked at the best animated feature, and I wanted to strangle somebody.
Oh, that's right. Boss Baby is also nominated for an Oscar.
And Ferdinand. So, from my perspective, an animated film about a baby that contains lots of poop jokes, and a film about a bowl, you know, basically...
I mean, but at least those. Ferdinand looks like a nice... Children's look, it's an animal and he wants to be friends.
They preferred those, though, to a silent voice.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what you wanted to get an Oscar.
No, I just wanted it to be nominated. I think it's the kind of movie that can help a lot of people, but...
So the thing is, Rob, a silent voice, it may be a great exploration of bullying and why people do it.
Yep.
But it doesn't have a baby in a suit.
This is true. It just has beautiful animation, amazing artwork, exceptional characters, and an excellent dub in both English and Japanese.
No, but Rob, see, it's a baby, but it's also the boss. But babies can't be bosses, Rob. Or can they?
No, because every kid I've seen, I just look at them and say, you're not the boss of me.
Incidentally, I've never seen Boss Baby. I have no idea what it's about. Is he a boss? Does he run a Fortune 500 company?
No,
I think that's basically the idea, yes.
Think Stewie Griffin the movie.
Oh, that makes me sad. Almost as sad as some people are over the fact that the Joker needs to be made to be gay.
Why?
Again.
Why?
No, gay. Joker is gay, as he always has been, apparently.
What?
That there's a petition out with I assume, hundreds of signatures to make for DC Comics to make the Joker gay again.
Why?
Oh, look, again?
Again.
Was he gay before?
Apparently so.
When?
So, according to superfan Elena Shestakova, who's made this petition, the Joker is a comic book character with almost 80 years' history, half of which he was portrayed as homosexual. For instance, in such significant graphic novels as Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns or Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth.
Having read both of those...
Neil Adams claimed the Joker was and always has been homosexual.
Having read both of those, I can honestly say there is no mention of the Joker being gay in either of them.
There wasn't even subtle subtext to suggest it.
No, there is a lot of subtext that suggests that the Joker wants Batman to admit that he is as crazy as everyone else in Arkham.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of subtext about that.
I kind of see where they're coming from.
Do you think perhaps they're confusing the first 40 years with the alternative use of the word gay?
I bet this has all arisen from that one issue where Batman was obsessed with Joker's boners.
Yeah, but...
But that, the only way to stop the Joker's boners is with a boner of our own.
Yeah, but this is the thing, you know? Joker just didn't just have a boner for Batman in that issue. He also had a boner for Gotham. So does that mean he's in love with the city?
Is that what being metrosexual means?
Possibly, and I hesitate to think about the manhole covers now.
Oh, I feel ill.
But see, I get where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Kind of, because the Joker is obsessed with Batman.
Yeah, but...
And like, you can make an argument that he is... Yeah, I was going to say, you can make an argument that the Joker is in love with Batman.
Yeah, but...
I feel like it's sort of a weird, creepy, hard-to-define thing.
See,
like, if you just say the Joker wants a bit of that, as we have established on this very show, disappointingly flabby Batbert.
Yep.
You just kind of lose some of the magic of the Joker, I feel.
Well, for me, it's saying that is kind of like saying, you know, I like my cutlery organized. Does that mean I'm in love with spoons? You know, I might be OCD about, you know, having cutlery all neat and organized. Do you see what I mean?
Maybe
Joker's just obsessive compulsive about Batman.
What, he wants to stick him in a drawer next to the forks and knives?
Well, maybe Joker is just that other kind of crazy where everything has to be, you know, he's so chaotic, but in his mind, it's kind of like, it's kind of obsessive compulsive. Everything has to be a certain way, and Batman has to be as crazy as he is.
See, personally, what I prefer with the Joker is you can say stuff like that, but then he'll go and, like, turn around and do something to completely defy that.
Yeah.
Because
he's
the Joker.
Yeah.
And I think he's the kind of character where if to achieve what he wants, he needs to be gay, he will be gay.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean to say that defines him.
No.
Yeah, I feel like part of the subtext is always, when he does camp it up, it's because he knows it's making Batman incredibly uncomfortable.
And, yeah, there's nothing he likes doing more than that. It's his favourite pastime, isn't it?
Yeah. Also, surely, is not making the Joker into just some, like, psychotic gay guy who has a crush on the main hero, just turning him into a really bad gay stereotype?
It's basically like every yaoi fanfiction in existence.
Yes, that's it. This petition wants to make the Joker yaoi.
Yes.
Excuse me, old person in the room, what's yaoi?
It's okay, Mick. It's not for you to understand.
Yeah.
Also, I already had to describe Vaw last week. I'm not describing yaoi as well.
God, you know you want to.
Give me a break.
No, you should. You're the link between us and the other generations, Andrew.
Right. So the thing is, Mick, sometimes when a pretty Japanese boy likes another pretty Japanese boy, that they have naughty fun times and lonely nerds like to write about it.
Okay.
And also those pretty Japanese boys are usually anime protagonists, or Captain America and Bucky, or Captain America and Iron Man.
All right.
Or Batman and Superman.
See, I thought that was slash fiction.
It was basically like the Japanese version.
Yeah.
All right.
Imagine slash fiction, but where everybody is designed to look beautiful and have sparkles.
Wait a minute, goddammit, Rob, you're the manga expert. Why am I explaining it?
Because I kept silent, so you'd have to.
You tricked me.
Anyway, I've got enough explanation now. Thank you.
You and Patrick Stewart both, you've ganged up against me.
And that's an entirely other type of fiction, which we'll cover next week.
Hey, speaking of really creepy things,
oi.
The Black Panther, the producer of Black Panther, Nate Moore, has said in an interview that they deliberately cut out a bit of the comics canon because it was kind of creepy.
Which bit?
The fact that in the comics, the Dora Milaje, the Black Panther's elite bodyguards,
yeah,
are also apparently all his wives.
Ah, yeah.
Ah.
And I feel like I had to include this story because it's ruined the movie for me. Because now all I can imagine is Black Panther rips off his mask and it's T'Challa. But then he rips off his T'Challa face and it's Papa Lazaru.
Oh. Did we just step into wrong territory there?
To be fair, we're always skirting around the edge of wrong territory.
This is true.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's the main reason I had the story in. Apart from that, yeah, I feel like it's a good thing to curse.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of weird and not really that necessary to the story or Black Panther's canon.
And it sort of backs up a bit of a stereotype, doesn't it?
Yeah. Speaking of bad stereotypes, this is another one. Hey, do you know what else is a bad stereotype?
What?
Every single character in Marvel's The Inhumans. That's right. It's back, guys. Inhumans Watch is back.
But for how long, Andrew?
Possibly the last installment.
We've said that the last like four or five times.
To be fair, that we've been saying that since the trailer came out.
True. No, we've been saying that since the first poster.
I know, but Inhumans, it's like the dog that got hit by a car and most of its guts are spilled out on the road, but it's still crawling along, one paw desperately twitching, and part of you hopes that maybe the little fella will be all right, even though it is a mess. But deep down you know, no, it's not. Anyway, ABC might have cancelled it without actually announcing it, because now, if you go on the ABC website and click the Inhumans link, all you get is an error message.
You see, now, if only someone had done that sort of 8 months ago in the ABC office and taken it as an omen.
Because you've got a lot of things you like about this. But I just like the entire symbolism of kind of ABC basically saying, yes, this was a mistake. Inhumans is an error.
Yeah. What I liked particularly about the story was the fact that, and I've got to get the wording exactly right, so let me just find it in the story.
Which, incidentally, is an article on CBR, just to give it its dues.
Yes. Alongside the strange decision to air the first few episodes in theatres, the show was plagued by Whig dramas and dramatically declining ratings. Now, why I like that phrase is, let's face it, we all know that in Hollywood, TV executives sit around and they look at the Nielsen ratings and they look at various age groups and see what the spread is and make decisions on the future of shows based on that kind of information and also take into account reviews.
Yeah.
I just wonder, had the Inhumans been the top rated show in its time slot, in its target age group, would they still have axed it because of the Whig dramas that it was plagued by?
I want to know more about the Whig dramas. I think they should do a show just about the Whig dramas.
Yeah, I think if you remade Inhumans but just used a bunch of Whigs on sticks, it would be an infinitely better show.
I just want them to do a Whig drama now, you know. Just one of those Latin American soap operas about Whigs. It'd be great.
So the other thing is that, you know, they're talking about the fact that the still to be ratified deal between Fox and Disney may mean that the X-Men can now reside within the MCU, and therefore there's no need for Inhumans. That deal will take months and months to go through. If they were going to be doing a season two, they'd need to start planning for it now, and that deal wouldn't affect it in the slightest.
See, I reckon the way they've cancelled this, I reckon they already planned the season two, and because of how poorly the first season was received, they basically just put it to one side quietly and haven't announced to anyone that they already prepared season two. Not filmed it, they just did all the planning and everything like that for it. Planned out the story, everything like that.
The other thing you've got to look at is the basic sort of fundamental resources available to them. You know, for season one, they had the backing of an IMAX co-production. IMAX pulled out.
Yep.
And the quality with IMAX's support.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh no, I want season two even more.
So season two would have a budget of about $4.50.
I know how they can use that. I know how they can use that. Puppets.
I think they can't even afford the puppets.
No, you just basically, you know, wooden spoon puppets.
Yeah, but you still have to pay someone to operate the puppets.
No, you just have one guy with different spoons. You can hold a spoon in between each finger.
Also, Rob, if you use puppets made out of wooden spoons for season two, How do you explain the sudden animated features of the lead characters?
I don't.
How do you explain that the season two Inhumans can suddenly express a far wider range of emotion?
It's the magic of Hollywood.
they could do a better Medusa if they got one of those Play-Doh hairdressers sets.
See, I was just thinking wooden spoon, take one of those old string mop things, dye it red, stick her on top of the wooden spoon. There you go. Instant Medusa.
And far more impressive than the one we got in season one.
Well, the hair would be animated. It would move around. You just need to shake the spoon a little bit.
See, usually this is the part where I'd make some kind of joke, like, oh, I know, in season two, all the Inhumans will find convenient ways to not use their powers and lose their costumes and have less normal clothes. But that's already happened. That was season one.
Medusa.
Saved off Medusa's hair with just, like, a bootstorm razor.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing that I don't understand. Her hair is supposed to be like ridiculously strong. You know, it's like steel cables, in fact.
Yeah.
How the hell did he. I mean, that's a bloody good razor. And it won't want.
Well,
that's because not even steel can stand up to the new Gillette Fusion.
Well.
There's turning to camera.
Excuse me, but I think I spotted early on the one piece of logic in the entire Inhumans run.
Oh.
And that was that when they wanted to stop Lockjaw going off, they locked him in that shielded room, which is also where they kept Black Bolt when they didn't want to destroy the world if he coughed. Yeah. So I suspect that room in some way dampens those aspects of their powers, and therefore it was perfectly safe to shave her with a normal razor whilst in that chamber.
Yeah, and what's the show going to do? Explain thought points like that.
So, hang on. They locked Lockjaw in a locked room?
Well, no, there was a chamber on New Atalan.
Okay.
That they shut him in. And it was also where they kept Black Bolt prisoner so that he couldn't...
Right, okay. And then they shaved Medusa in that room.
That's the logical reason why they could do it with an ordinary razor, yes.
Okay. So it wasn't a Gillette Fusion then?
It could well... I think you'll find that Gillette Fusion... Within the universe of other razors are available, within the context of superheroes, is equivalent to just a bolt store razor.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, no other razor has like five blades and is so sharp it has to be protected by bars or whatever it is.
No, that's Wilkinson's sword.
Is it?
Yes.
Look, if either of them want to sponsor the show, I'm up for it.
Yes. And the first one to do it, we'll do a live video where we use Rob as a Medusa stand-in to show you how it was done.
No, don't. No shaving me. No shaving me. I don't trust you guys.
Incidentally, I think we're going to need multiple razors.
Not if we put him in the special chamber.
Also known as the bathroom.
I mean, that probably was the set used, just someone's bathroom.
It's where I do all my best thinking.
I mean, if the throne room of Atalan can be basically a warehouse.
Hey, the bathroom is technically the throne room, I'll have you know.
It's, I'm not entirely sure that anyone's going to mourn the loss of that particular franchise.
There will be one person. You know there's always one.
Yeah, but I'm sure the guy who plays Black Bolt will find other work eventually.
What, as an angel standing? Because as soon as I saw him, my first thought was, hang on, isn't that David, what's his face, from Angel?
He does look a bit like David Boreanaz.
See, David, what's his face?
I thought he looked more like an angry Pierce Brosnan.
He does kind of as well.
Slightly more buff Derek Zoolander.
Oh, hang on, does that mean when they sealed him up, he had to practice his look?
I mean, that was literally every single scene Black Bolt was in. It was just him doing Blue Steel.
It's because he's practicing for Magnum.
Oh, dear.
Oh, anyway.
We have to carry on talking about Inhumans. No.
Any more news?
That's it. Our panel, as we know, is cancelled. We are now purely an Inhumans recap podcast. going through every episode again and again until the heat death of the universe.
Oh, so any other news?
No, that's it. We're done.
All right. Shall we take a break?
Yes,
yeah, go for it.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares.
Hello, fellow Vault Hunters. I'm J. Michael Tatum, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello. We're Literary Loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
And welcome back. And now the time of the show that I like to call Stuff What We've Read.
That's a terrible name that'll never catch on.
That's why I keep it to myself usually. But I believe Andrew is going to share with us first.
Yep, so I have been reading Nick Fury, Deep Cover Capers, which is a 6-issue series by, James Robinson. I was going to say Nick Robinson, but that's a completely different person.
Yeah.
That's like the BBC political correspondent.
Yeah, I now want him to write anything that ends with the word capers in its title.
See, I always get confused, or I used to anyway, until I gained the vocabulary. Between capers, as in, you know...
Come on, guys. If you're going to get hung up on the capers, we're never going to get to the main course.
Hey!
Andrew knew where I was going.
So that was possibly the best joke I've ever made.
Oh, no. You've had a couple that are better.
Anyway, the art on this is by someone known only as Aiko.
Really?
I know. But I'm not going to question them, because they do some of that good art.
Okay, cool.
So this series, it's about Nick Fury Jr., For those who don't know it, Nick Fury's son, who conveniently just so happens to look exactly like the Samuel L. Jackson version of Nick Fury.
Hang on, did a 90s Punisher thing happen to him?
It's a long and drawn-out saga, and I'm not going to reach over and get the vault to go through it with you.
Okay.
Anyway, it's just ignore it. It's fine. This is Nick Fury now. The idea is each issue, it's kind of a self-contained story. And it's appropriate that you mentioned you like anything that ends in caper, because each story ends in the something caper. There's like the Sky High caper, the Locomotion Assassination caper, the Samurai and Moonbeams caper.
Did you say the Samurai and Moonbeams caper?
Yep.
See, that
which
just...
is about Nick Fury fighting the Yakuza on the moon.
See, when you say it like that, I just want a Nick Fury movie just about that now.
I mean, basically, each issue of this is like someone took a James Bond movie and, like, pushed it through a sieve and just sort of filtered out all the boring, you know, like, people talking about stuff bits and just left the really cool action scenes. Like, issue one, Nick Fury infiltrates a casino, kind of breaks into a high-class vault, has to fight Hydra, escapes in a flying car, gets chased by a flying battleship, outmaneuvers the flying battleship and makes it crash into a cliff.
As you do.
Then issue two, as I said, fights the Yakuza, who of course have giant samurai robots on the moon.
Well, where
then
else?
Issue three, he fights a bunch of assassins that are basically the Power Rangers, but with like Day of the Dead masks on a train. Issue four, goes to Atlantis and fights it. I mean, that one is the obvious one in that it goes to Atlantis, fights bad Atlanteans.
So, is this more like Nick Fury punches his way around the world?
I mean, in issue five, he literally has to fight an entire town of assassins.
Are they all ninjas? We've got to check.
No, they are not all ninjas.
Oh, okay. It is starting to sound more like Street Fighter, World Warrior.
I mean, to be fair, in the final issue, he goes to a haunted Scottish castle and fights a monster that does look a heck of a lot like Blanca. But yeah, it's fun. I would say that the writing is like less of a draw because, you know, each issue is short, so it's just Nick Fury goes to a place, has a fight.
Yeah.
But what really makes it is just the art, which it is phenomenal. quite like a lot of it. It's basically the idea is that he's using his eye patch thing, which has like a bunch of scanning technology in it. So lots of the stuff happens in like a series of concentric circles, which is just a really nice effect. And it's just everything is like a big, bright, colourful splash page.
Awesome. I think I'm going to have a read of this.
Actually, flicking through it, just visually, it does kind of look a lot like Next Wave. Just, you know, very bright, over-the-top, explodey action.
Yeah, and who doesn't like Next Wave?
No one doesn't like Next Wave, because it's the best comic. That's why it won my Comic of the Year 2017 award. Also, Mick, was that you asking what Next Wave is?
Yes.
See, the thing is, it's like Shakespeare, but with more punching.
Oh, well.
Yeah, when he says it's like Shakespeare, he's more referring to Much Ado About Nothing or A Midsummer Night's Dream rather than, say, Macbeth.
Okay.
In the second issue, a robot man cuts his way out of a dragon's belly.
Yeah, but Fing Fang Foom did put Boom Boom in his pants.
He did indeed, so he deserved it.
You should read Next Wave, Mick. It's a lot of fun.
You should read Next Wave, Mick.
Okay.
Do it now. Stop the show and go read Next Wave.
Well, I'd have to get hold of Next Wave in order to do that, so let's leave it for between shows, shall we?
Yes. Okay, moving on to me then, yeah?
Yeah, moving on to you.
Right, I have something from DK Books. Black Panther, the movie, is coming out. We mentioned Black Panther earlier in the show with the, what was it, the...
Creepy bit.
The creepy bit with whatever the names are, I've forgotten.
His bodyguards and not his wives.
Yeah, the Dora Milaje. This is actually DK Book's Black Panther, The Ultimate Guide, which actually has some interesting bits in it. One of the bits about the Dora Milaje, for example, they were saying that the members of the Dora Milaje were chaste and untouchable brides in waiting, forbidden all romantic liaisons because they are symbolically pledged to the king. Instead, the adored ones are trained as the ultimate bodyguards, symbols of his wealth and power, as well as his last line of defence, which is the creepy bit that everyone's talking about.
See, you can just say they're his bodyguards.
Yeah, that's, I know, this is the thing. They don't have to be brides-in-waiting or anything like that. But yeah, this is actually quite an interesting collection of tidbits of information about Black Panther, how he began, where he came from, you know, his dubious origins with the name Cold Tiger, for example.
Oh, yeah, that was like his original thing. Also, there was a time when he was called the Black Leopard because he didn't want to be associated with the Black Panthers.
Yeah, it's interesting because Cold Tiger actually appeared as a version of Black Panther in an alternate universe. So, and then they've got... White? They've got his adopted brother, Hunter, who is White Panther, is he? Or something like that?
White Tiger, maybe?
Because this is the thing, I didn't know that he was supposed to have an adopted brother. I didn't know a lot of Black Panther's history. I didn't know that Shuri became the Black Panther for a period of time. Didn't know anything about, Ramonda.
Oh, yeah, she did.
So all of this is a lot of this is new information to me, and I've been reading Black Panther on and off for a while. So a lot of this stuff is just, I mean, we all know that Claw is one of his main enemies, but there are others like Killmonger. Killmonger being, being kind of his arch nemesis more so than Claw.
Yeah, of course, but Killmonger is one of those characters I'm kind of vaguely aware of, but know nothing about.
Well, according to this, Killmonger is T'Challa's archenemy, and he's an exiled Wakandan who believes he can do a far better job of ruling the African nation through sheer determination and mastery of science. N'Jadaka transforms himself into Eric Killmonger, a truly fearsome warrior who is the Black Panther's superior, and not even death can deter Killmonger from his mission.
Hold on, did you just say he transforms into Eric Killmonger?
Yeah, he uses science and stuff and turns himself and adopts a new name.
Right. What kind of nemesis calls themselves Eric?
I mean, I feel like the Eric and the Killmonger kind of balance each other out.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you can't just go around saying, my name's Kill, surname Monger.
No, you just go by one name, wouldn't you? Killmonger.
Well, I don't know, like, you know.
That, in and of itself, is a cool enough name. It's you don't have Bruce Wayne's alter ego going around saying, "Hi, I'm Colin Batman."
Yeah, this is true. But then again, you know, maybe Mrs. Munger had four sons and named them, like, you know, Death, Famine, War, and Pestilence.
Pestilence Munger.
I mean, at this point, I feel the need to mention that Magneto has one of his acolytes, who is a giant hulking green monster named Seamus Mellencamp. And he just, that's just his name, and it's what he goes by.
But that's fine, because that's just an ordinary name. It's not a combination of ordinary name and super cool villain name.
White Wolf, that's what his adopter's brother's called. So, yeah.
Maybe he had to name himself Eric Killmonger so he could fill out tax returns.
Well, yeah, actually.
They don't just let you have a last name.
Yeah, this is true. You know, also for passports and stuff like that. I mean, it's not like Cher has Cher on her passport, is it?
Yeah,
oh, yeah. You get Thanos at the border in Cali. He has an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, because that's what supervillains concern themselves with, is the requirements for civil obedience.
Well,
smart supervillains do.
Yeah, smart supervillains. But also, what if Thanos is just his middle name? What if his first name is the Mad God, just all one word, and his, you know, his surname is of Titan?
Actually, fun fact. Well, I think, I don't remember which one it was, but one of the recent comics revealed that Thanos is just a name he gave himself. His actual name is Dion.
Hang on, Dion as in Dion Dublin?
Yep.
Sorry, I'm just imagining how Thanos presenting Holmes Under the Hammer.
You do realise that during this episode, comics are starting to sound less and less cool.
Black Panther Guide. If you like Black Panther, do yourself a favour and get it. It's got some good bits of information, some great artwork.
Yes.
It covers a lot of the
amazing adventures of Norman Black Panther.
Sorry. I've got Thanos doing Holmes Under the Hammer.
But quite frankly, if all we accomplish with this show is making one person realise that comics are in fact incredibly silly, I can die a happy man. Because comics are super dumb, and that's why I love them.
I really want that now. I really want Thanos doing Holmes Under the Hammer. Just with this really, really cheesy production. Just a giant purple guy.
Four panel, we return in a moment when Rob's taking his medication.
Mick, you took over. You take over your turn.
Right. Okay. So we've had a bit of extreme capery from Andrew, and we've had some extreme silliness from Rob.
As always.
So I'm going to take it back to a little bit of seriousness and cover something a bit more edumacational. Ah, yeah, that's right. So I've got Rick Geary's Treasury of Victorian Murder Compendium Volume 1, which is published by NBM Graphic Novels. Now, originally when I said, "Ooh, give me some of that, I'll do that on the show," it was because I was starting to feel a bit neglected and left out because everybody else was doing some super cool gothic stuff and I wasn't getting any. So I thought, this'll be my super cool gothic stuff, expecting something akin to like From Hell or something like that. And what I've actually got is a history textbook in comic format. What it reminds me of is years ago you used to get the Boyzone paper annuals.
And are you talking, is Boyzone as in boys and then on?
No.
Or Boyzone as in Boyzone, the band?
That's boys as in Boys-O-W-N.
Yeah, two separate words.
In, yeah.
Yeah. I was
not,
just checking.
Not Run and Kipling's Greatest Hits, no.
I was just checking there, all right.
So the Boyzone paper was a sort of magazine that sort of covered survival skills and how to make sort of Quinjets out of balsa wood and stuff like that. And every year it used to do a sort of annual, which would have the sort of pick of that year's articles in. And they would do historical or educational bits about scientific discoveries and stuff. And they'd do it in a sort of comic strip format. And this is what this reminds me of. The artwork is quite densely illustrated. But the thing is, if you've never read about any of the more famous Victorian murder mysteries, then it's quite interesting. But if you've ever sort of sat there on a night flipping through the channels and finding like the unsolved murders type program, it's basically one of those in a comic book format. And if you already know the stories, it's quite dull. And most of these stories I already knew. You've got things like the Beast of Chicago, who is the first methodical serial killer, a man called H.H. Holmes, who purpose-built a hotel that had traps in for the
unwary. He was America's first serial killer.
He was.
Isn't that just Saw you've just described?
Yes. Basically, he was Jigsaw, but before they'd realised that you could make a money-spinning franchise out of it. There's the assassination of President Garfield, Jack the Ripper, but it's Jack the Ripper because this is a compendium. It's quite an old retelling of the Jack the Ripper case, so it doesn't even include some of the newer evidence that's come to light over the past sort of decade or so.
So it is just like From Hell about Jack the Ripper and kind of disappointing.
Well, yeah, but at least with From Hell, there was some originality to it in terms of imagining the story in a different way. This is literally just a newspaper report, effectively. And this body was found on August the 15th. And they arrested 14 men and let them all go. And then on August the 15th, another murder happened.
So basically it's like Crime Watch graphic novel form. Crime Watch graphic novel form.
So, you know, if you're the kind of person who'd be interested in reading these kind of grisly Victorian murders for the first time, it's well paced, it's worth a read. With the exception possibly of the Jack the Ripper bit, because some of it is so similar that you find yourself feeling like you've looked at these panels before, and it's easy to lose your place in the Jack the Ripper tale. Some of them have got a quite bizarre twist. But they're all stories that you can find in less dense formats on Wikipedia or other internet-based search engines. So would I recommend it? No. Would I read it again? No. Is the information already available in other, is it more easily accessible formats? Yes. So although it's less adventurous and exciting than Andrew's review, and although it's less silly than Rob's review, it doesn't sound half as much fun as either of them. You can see now why I wanted to give it back.
It's all right, Mick. You can keep it. It's fine.
I don't want to.
Andrew.
Okay, so there's a rite of passage on this show that I have yet to go through. But now, this week, I've done it. I've read a Hodorowsky.
Yay! Is it a slim Hodorowsky?
It is a very slim Hodorowsky. It is the magical... Yep, the Magical Twins, which was written as part of the Humanoids Kids sort of banner. And so it's like only 50 pages long instead of being called.
That's a very slim Hodorowsky.
Yep.
That's barely a preface.
Not unlike the Inkle, it isn't scrawled on just an entire forest. So this is about two twins, Prince Aram and Princess Mara. Guys, their name is the same thing, but backwards. I've literally only just noticed while reading the book. This is how very invested I was in the book. Anyway, that their father, the king, gets taken prisoner by the Dark Master Tartarus, and so they have to go on an adventure with the magical dragon bird Lyrina to save him. It's... You know what, guys?
What?
I'm disappointed.
What? Why? In the book or Hodorowsky?
In the book. Because after, like, the brain-melting, confusing horror of the Inkle, this is just a fairly, like, standard fantasy book for kids. Like, I think because it's only 50 pages, on the one hand, it sort of helps that Hodorowsky's obviously had to slim down a lot of his wilder inklings.
Was that a joke about the Inkle?
So do you not have a succession of characters turning up out of the blue without any prior knowledge of their existence or mention of them?
Oh, absolutely, but It's just, it's very formulaic. The twins go to a place, they get told that the Dark Wizard is a master of illusion, so you must use all your senses to not fall into the traps. They then immediately fall into the trap, and have to either bumble their way out or get rescued by their magic dragon friend. And then they beat up a monster, and so it becomes their friend. Rinse and repeat, like, 5 or 6 times.
Right.
Also, they're masters of kung fu and can fire brain lasers and also become lighter than gravity, which they do once and never again.
So, Jedi, then?
Basically.
So it sounds like a very watered-down version of the same thing we experienced with our adventures in this universe, in that this one has the advantage that it's a story sort of for kids, but it's that kind of overexcited kid building a story as it goes along.
Yeah, it's very much there. It's basically one of your bog-standard fantasy narratives with bits stapled on, which are just Horowski going, "Oh, look how fanciful and creative I am. What if there's an octopus, but it's made of plants?
Yeah.
What if there's a lizard minotaur that gets stronger when you hit it?
A lizard minotaur?
What if there was Candyland, but the candy is monsters? What if dragons could fire stones out their mouths?
The candy monster would explain Bertie Bassett.
I think you'll find that was already explained in the Happiness Patrol episode of Doctor Who in 1987.
That's good. That's what people listen for, these culturally relevant references.
Never deny the cultural relevance of Doctor Who. It was around before you were born, and it'll be around long after you've gone from this world.
That's because you're assuming that Andrew is not the Doctor.
Well, I know he's not the Doctor, because the Doctor's a girl.
The year is 1399. Earth is a blasted hellscape after the latest nuclear fallout wars. All that remains are cockroaches and Doctor Who reruns.
Sounds like paradise.
Anyway, there was one bit of the magical twins I liked.
Oh?
As I mentioned before, they have a magical dragon bird called Lyrina.
Mm-hmm.
And her thing is she has magic powers that will let her do basically anything, but she can only do that once a year. And she brings it up constantly, all the time, whenever doing anything. And it gets to a point in the book where just the twins turn to her and say, "Will you just shut up about the once-a-year thing?" And I think that's the one point in this book when I actually identified with the characters. Because I was equally frustrated with the dragon monster's constant whining.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And I think that was the other thing that got me with the Jodorowsky was, there were elements that were likeable, but they were just so impenetrable to get to. You came across them, and then they were gone, like a fleeting glimpse of something that could have been nice.
Yeah,
and it just disappeared.
So I think it makes my criticism more valid that even in a longer book, it's just a parade of things happening with no real rhyme or reason to them.
Hmm.
Yeah. See, this is where you had the advantage with the Inkle over Weapons of the Meta Baron, Mick. Because at least in the Inkle, you had those little bits. In Weapons of the Meta Baron, there were none.
And at least the Magical Twins was short.
I'm talking about 4 panels out of 400 pages, Rob.
There weren't even 4 in Weapons of the Meta Baron. Okay, everything was this poor, horrible CG-style artwork, and everybody was speaking like they were on some really bad, you know, daytime soap opera about sci-fi, medieval, fantasy type things.
Uh-oh. Someone sounds like they're coming down with a bad case of vampires of the mind.
Yes.
I should use that as an excuse to get off work one day.
I won't be in today because I've been attacked by vampires of the mind.
No, he's got a bad case of vampires of the mind.
So...
Yes.
Out of our regular rotation of presenters, I believe we've only got one left who hasn't been Jodorowsky.
We do.
Yep. So it'll be Rob's turn at some point. But anyway, shall we move on to me?
Yes.
Right. I'll let you guys pick. Your choice. Teora Tetney Volume 2 or Cardcaptor Sakura Clear Card Volume 1?
I'm going to go with the latter because it's harder for you to say.
Is To Your Eternity that one that you keep saying I'll like, but then I completely forget everything you've said about it?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, do the other one then.
All right. Cardcaptor Sakura. It's not a name that... well, let's put it this way. Cardcaptor Sakura is a name that will be very, very familiar to anime fans of a certain age because they watched Cardcaptor when they were kids. It was the one that introduced them to kind of Studio Clam, who are an all-female manga studio. It introduced them to Cloud Cards, to the character of Sakura Kinamoto, and Shaoran, and all of the other stuff that they grew to know and love. It was kind of their first, for a lot of people, it was their first introduction to the idea of a magical girl in anime. And Cardcaptor has been finished for a long time, right? The Cloud Cards were all found. Everything was hunky-dory. Shaoran went back to Hong Kong to sort stuff out. And Shaoran is like the male interest for Sakura. And everything is fine. Everything's hunky-dory. Sakura is going into middle school now. And she's missing Shaoran. And Shaoran has come back because he wants to spend more time with Sakura. And, you know, everything is... everything's hunky-dory. But something has happened. You know, when she's just starting middle school, something is going on and she's not sure what. She discovers that the Cloud Cards have all become blank and instead she has these clear cards instead. She's not sure what's going on, but she's determined to find out. And this is the first volume in that. And I've read some of Clamp's kind of Clampverse stuff in the past, and this is kind of keeping up with the rest of the Clampverse. Studio Clamp is one of the only manga studios in Japan to have created this kind of connected universe type thing where you have X-Holic and X and Cardcaptor and various others, and they all connect through dimensions in the way that Marvel does with various characters that it has and way DC does with its various Earths. It's a nice thing to see, and I reckon Cardcaptor Sakura is one of those that will kind of branch out in the way that Tsubasa Reservoir Chronicle did, which was like an alternate take on the whole Cardcaptor Sakura story. Now, I know you two are probably thinking, I have no idea what the hell he's talking about.
Oh my god, he's stolen Professor X's telepathic powers.
He has.
Right.
It's like he's a vampire of the mind.
I'm not. I just know which audience this is aimed at very, very well. All right. The anime adaptation of Cardcaptor Sakura Clear Card, I think it's already started or will start very, very soon. And the manga version is worth a read if you're a diehard fan of Cardcaptor Sakura. And I know there are diehard fans of the franchise out there. There are lots of them, in the same way that there are diehard fans of Take That.
I still have all my old Pokemon cards.
See?
Am I a card captor?
Yes.
Hooray, I've engaged with this text.
But technically you're a card captor because you have loads of Pokemon cards, but you can't be a proper card captor because you're not a magical girl.
But I do have a Blastoise.
I don't want to know about that.
So who's the real magical girl?
I don't want to know about your Blastoise.
You can get a cream for it.
I definitely don't want to know about my Studio Clam.
anyway, Mick.
Yes. Is it just me, or am I turning into the voice of reason this week?
Yes.
I mean, I think I'm turning into the voice of realizing that I don't have to understand what anyone's talking about. I can just make crude innuendos.
Did we do a character swap or something when you use it?
I didn't realise that Lurgy was that virulent that I caught when I went up to it.
It was Patrick Stewart.
And I usually the one doing the dodgy innuendo.
Yeah.
I don't like this, Mick.
I like is that the bit in which we accidentally played a video of Patrick Stewart talking is going to get completely cut from this episode. So no one's going to know why we're screaming about Patrick Stewart.
Absolutely.
So. This is it. We've finally been broken by four panel. Now all the room is incoherent howling.
All right, Mick, put us out of our misery.
Okay, so I've delved into the Dark Circle comics universe again. Regular listeners may remember that a few weeks ago I did The Shield, And this is a relaunch of some titles that used to be around in the sort of 40s and 50s from Dark Circle Comics, which was the sort of, it was like the Vertigo version of Archie Comics.
Yeah. Wasn't it Red Circle back then or something like that? Yeah, I think
I think it was Dark Circle.
No, because I think it's Dark Circle now. I think it was Red Circle back then.
Possibly.
As the stain has gone on, it's gone from a red circle to a dark circle.
Yeah.
it's blackened with age.
But anyway, it's the mature, violent imprint of Archie Comics.
Have you read Archie Comics lately? They don't need a mature, violent imprint. They are.
I've never read an Archie comic in my life.
Archie versus Predator, Archie gets killed, you know, undead Archie and various things like that. Archie versus Predator was creepy and violent at the same time.
I'm sure Riverdale's got something about a vigilante running around murdering people now.
Yep.
That's a strange show.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the subject matter. So I covered The Shield a few weeks ago, which is one of their superhero comics. But they're superheroes with a difference. They don't tend to choose to be superheroes, and the Hangman is another example of that. So there's a perpetual Hangman. There is always a Hangman around, and it's a very similar tale to Ghost Rider. Live a bad life, you come to a sticky end, and then the devil sends you up to harvest the souls of other bad people. The slight twist here is that after a while, you clear your balance sheet. And once you clear your balance sheet, you ascend to heaven.
Okay. Your balance sheet, I'm assuming, is criminals who you've basically captured and hanged.
Yeah, so basically the idea is, let's say that heaven has decreed that you are a bad person and that in order to wipe out all the badness that you've done, you need to take the souls of 723 bad people.
Okay.
The minute you take soul number 723, you ascend to heaven. And the owner of soul 723 takes your place.
Okay. Oh, okay. So basically, he's not the Ghost Rider. He's just a very naughty boy.
Yeah. But it's that similar sort of thing in that, you know, you're working on behalf of someone else to reap those souls.
I mean, did either of you ever watch the show Dead Like Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's basically like a gritty version of that.
Yeah, it actually kind of reminds me of Brimstone. Did you guys ever watch that? It was the one about the cop who killed...
No, Rob. No one has ever seen your shows. That's how this works.
Damn you all. Brimstone was good. It had a good character play of the devil as well.
So, in this one, obviously, the preferred method for dispatching these bad guys is the Hangman's noose.
Does he challenge them to a word game beforehand?
No. So the Hangman is something of an urban myth for most, but a lot of the sort of old world criminal underworld, they know the legend and believe in it.
So he's like Kaiser Soze?
Yeah, if you like. But there are rules to being the Hangman. So you're only allowed to go for the souls that have been targeted. You can't go freelance just because someone hacked you off in an earlier life. And you're sent out there by the devil. Now, the devil's got other problems, as well as all these souls that need reaping, in that there are demons out there that want to take control of hell. And some of them are walking the earth. And some of them are trying to get involved in your life and using you to break the rules to cause problems. So that's where it deviates from that standard sort of Reaper type thing. And it's actually not bad. It's a little bit Ghost Rider, a little bit Punisher at times. Even the devil, there's an element of the Lucifer style of devil in there.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting read to the point where it ends where the Hangman, our new Hangman, is, about to, talk with Asmodeus, who's one of the demons plotting against the devil. So it very much sounds like Mike Mignetta, the current incumbent of the Hangman role, is going to do this on his own terms. The art style is colourful, but it's more of a sketch art style that's then coloured in rather than a sort of bold lines.
Okay.
The panel layouts are interesting. There's there's a sort of female femme fatale who could be a sort of witch associate of the demon Asmodeus. And there's a lot of your sort of standard horror tropes in, like, you know, crows being used as messengers and that kind of thing. But it doesn't feel cliched for all that. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. Interestingly, as we mentioned Archie Comics earlier, at the end, after the main Hangman story, there's a special preview of Jughead the Hunger, which
is Jughead as a zombie. It's Jughead as a zombie, isn't it?
No.
Jughead as a vampire.
No! Go on, go for a third try.
Jughead when he's hungry.
Jughead as a werewolf.
Andrew gets the point.
Yeah!
And it's basically Riverdale, but with this undercurrent of lycanthropy and a freak show circus on the edge of town and people just being found with guts and entrails pouring out of the left, right and centre, which is the first time I've ever been tempted to read an Archie comic.
See, I told you, Archie comics are a lot more violent than people think.
I'm only interested in Jughead the Hunger. I'm not interested in the rest of it. But yeah, so The Hangman, it's another good read. And as I've mentioned, after reading The Shield, I'd be interested in seeing what's in store when reading The Fox and The Black Hood.
Well, I know
that... The Mighty Crusaders.
The Mighty Crusaders is already releasing issues, isn't it?
Yep. So, but yeah. And there's some interesting little extras, like preview sketches, as well as stories about the recreation of these classic comic heroes. And it's really well written, and I enjoyed it.
Awesome.
So there. And if you don't enjoy it, it sucks to be you.
Yes. Of course, you're entitled to your opinion.
As long as it's the same as mine, yes.
Yes. On that note, we are at the end of the show, so all of our shows are available on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. We have a Patreon, which you can find the links to on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or head to Patreon and look for The Geek Show. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or our own Twitter feed, which is Andrew.
At 4Panel Podcast.
Or you can email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. That's it from us. We'll see you all next week with more comic books, manga, and various other things. Until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.